Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama ordered military action in Libya, then headed for a week-long tour of Latin America. He left the nation wondering what the goal was, both abroad and on key domestic issues, the budget, energy, Social Security. His reticence has critics on the left calling him the Where's Waldo president, and critics on the right arguing incompetence. Is he deflecting responsibility or playing a deft hand? This hour, On Point, President Obama's leadership in tumultuous times. You can join the conversation. Do you see President Obama as a strong leader now? Did the U.S. move fast enough to take action on Libya? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Matthew Iglesias, a fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and a prominent blogger on the website Think Progress. Matt Iglesias, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
With us from New York is Raihan Salam, columnist for the iPad news source, The Daily, and a policy advisor for the nonprofit economic research organization Economics 21. He's co-author of Grand New Party, How Conservatives Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Raihan Salam, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
And joining us here in the studio is David Gergen, professor of public service at the Harvard Kennedy School and director of its Center for Public Leadership. He served as an advisor to Presidents Reagan, Nixon, Ford, and Clinton. David Gergen, always glad to have you here and good to see you today.
Glad to be back, Bob. Thank you.
Raihan Salam, first question to you. What do you make of the president's response to Libya? What should we make of it?
I think that it's very hard to say. The president has not done a very good job of articulating his goals, and there's a lot of tension here. Do we want regime change there? Is this primarily a humanitarian intervention? And what exactly is our end game in Libya? And I think that there's something a little troubling about the idea that the public is so uncertain about what the goals are, and I hope that we're going to get a clearer sense of that soon.
Matt Iglesias, same question to you. What should we make of the president's decision-making on Libya, and what did we gain, what did he gain by waiting to make that decision?
Well, clearly what was gained by taking more time and taking a more patient approach is a much broader range of international support, a resolution at the United Nations Security Council, a leadership role by the government and military of France, support from the Arab League. I think there's some costs to that kind of delay, and also building a broad coalition has made it difficult to communicate to people exactly what it is that he's hoping to achieve here. But there have been some real gains from taking time and building a broad global consensus.
David Gergen, does the president deserve criticism or praise for his decision-making on the intervention in Libya?
Mixed. You know, Bob, the American voters often bring to power someone who is just the opposite of what they thought they just had and tries to, you know, balance off what they thought were the weaknesses of a previous president. And in this case, the American voters voted in Barack Obama thinking that they, by having George W. Bush retire, that someone who was often seen as reckless, fairly or not fairly, was seen as reckless as getting us into war. They elected someone who would be very cautious about the use of force. And I think the question now becomes, is he overly cautious? And in this case, I think he, by dragging his feet the way he did, yes, he got the international coalitions, but we lost extraordinarily valuable time, and it's going to be much tougher now to prevail in Libya and get Gaddafi out of there than it would have been had the international coalition acted 10 days ago.
So did he feel his way into this, or was this a steady course of decision making?
How about being dragged? The others may disagree, but my sense is that both France and the UK were pulling the coalition forward, the Western nations and NATO nations forward. The Arab League came in. That was very important. But also events on the ground changed. And the president went from being the reluctant warrior, didn't want to get in, into a head-snapping reversal of policy that I don't think anybody saw coming as quickly as it did in the way it came, sort of the tortured way it came, just saying, we're going in. But we're going to, as he did in Afghanistan, We're going to go in, but we're going to do it very cautiously. You know, in Afghanistan, we have a surge, but we have a deadline. In Libya, we're going to use our forces, but they're not going to be there very long. We're going to hand it over to everybody else.
Well, let me ask you this question. In terms of presidential leadership, do you think the president might not have acted if Secretary of State Clinton, if Susan Rice hadn't gotten on board for military action? And let's hear what Senator Lindsey Graham had to say about this on Fox News Sunday.
Well, I'm glad we're finally doing something. I don't know how many people have died as we wait to do something. Thank God for strong women in the Obama administration. I don't know what finally got the president to act, but I'm very worried that we're taking a back seat rather than a leadership role.
Raihan Salon, you first on this.
Well, look, I don't think it's obvious that we always and everywhere have to take a leadership role. I think that there is a real danger with Britain writing checks they can't cash. This is a situation where Britain has sharply reduced its military expenditures, and they're doing it for a good reason. And I think that if you look at the French as well, France is extremely close to Libya, and they have legitimate concerns regarding refugee outflows, etc. And they also have decent military capability. And I think that the idea of being dragged into this by allies who are not taking a full account of what our needs are and what our restraints are regarding other military commitments really does trouble me. And I do think that it might have been a demonstration of leadership for the president to say, you know, wait a second, we are not going to be dragged into this precipitously. I understand that David Gergen has fairly, and Matt Iglesias have both fairly suggested that the president was very deliberate about this. But what troubles me is, well, how deliberate was he about this, given that we still don't know exactly what the goal is? And so I wonder if, you know, maybe we should have been willing to not take the lead this time around.
Matt Iglesias, take that on.
Well, no, I agree with what Raihan is saying, that I think that critique is closer to the mark than Senator Graham's criticism. I think that what Senator Graham is missing by suggesting that the United States should have acted earlier is what the costs and problems would have been of another United States unilateral military intervention. And the real question here isn't, did we wait too long, but it's, should we have done this at all? I mean, given the reasons that we were reluctant to go in, should we have really allowed the desires of the French and British governments to sort of push us into bolstering them here? I mean, it's possible that we could have given diplomatic support, something like that, to a French mission if they had wanted to do it. But it does seem to me that the president has undertaken a mission that, as of a couple weeks ago, he did not really want the United States to bear the load of. And now we're sort of hoping that this can be handed off to France and the United Kingdom, but it's not totally clear that they can pull it off without more extensive American support.
David?
Well, my sense of it is that had the president wanted to do this, and had this been something the United States had encouraged quietly behind the scenes, we could have gotten the Arab League and the UN resolution much earlier than we did, and therefore we would have been in before Gaddafi basically took over most of the country, and the military proposition here would be easier, and the rebels would have a better chance of throwing Gaddafi out. It's also true that what happened the last two or three days, and I do agree with Senator Lindsey Graham on one point. You know, we thought for a long time if we could just have more women in power, it would bring us peace. And in this case, the great irony is, of course, it were three women who talked to the president into doing it: Hillary Clinton, Samantha Power, and Susan Rice. And more power to them. I salute them for it.
Do you think, are you convinced that he would not have taken the action he did, join this intervention, had they not pushed for it?
I'm persuaded he would probably not have gone in. After all, he according to the reports we have, that both Hillary Clinton, Secretary of Defense, and Bob Gates, his Secretary of Defense, as well as his National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, all opposed going in early on. And then Hillary flipped when she saw events on the ground and she had a chance to talk to the rebel leaders and all the rest. But I want to go back to one point that Ryan has been making, and that is the way this was done. I happen to be in support of the intervention, but the way it was done at the last minute and with the rush and without I think a lot of deliberation has left all sorts of question marks over the whole campaign about what it is we're trying to do. In particular, The president has said now we have a two-track approach to Libya. We have a humanitarian track under the UN, which is to essentially to stop Gaddafi and protect civilians. But we also have a U.S. policy, as distinguished from a UN policy. And the U.S. policy, the second track, is we want Gaddafi out of there, not through military intervention, but through sanctions and other non-military means. Well, that leaves all sorts of questions open about what do we do with the rebels if they now go on the offensive? Do we help the rebels? Do we not help the rebels? Are we going to recognize the rebels? No one knows the answer to a whole host of questions surrounding this.
Okay. There's a whole host of questions that I think come out of that. Do you feel that there is no clear plan, no exit strategy for the U.S. here going forward?
Well, maybe Matt or Ryan can answer this, but I don't have a sense that the U.S. has a united view about what we do if this devolves into a stalemate.
Ryan Salam.
This has been one of the most chaotic years in global history, certainly since 2001. And I think that, you know, there are a couple of ways you can respond to that. One is to believe that we should be a very predictable actor in international affairs. We should have a very clear lodestar about the kind of things we hope to achieve, what are our highest international priorities, or we could be incredibly reactive. And I think that it's very hard to be a backseat driver in this case. I mean, the president is dealing with a very chaotic situation, and as the unfolding crises across the Arab world have developed, I think that he's been forced to pivot back and forth. So to some degree, that's understandable. But I think that my fundamental concern is, well, there's no exit strategy here. And also, the fact that there seems to be this bobbing and weaving, this unpredictability, I think that creates a danger that other elements in other states are going to think, well, wait a second, maybe if we pursue some kind of revolt, then we'll receive some kind of assistance as well. And, you know, many people have raised the fact that, you know, in Bahrain, for example, we have, you know, we've taken a very different position. So I think that's a big problem.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about President Obama's leadership on key issues. You can join the conversation. Should the president have canceled his trip to Latin America in light of the big crises in Japan and the Middle East? How would you like to see President Obama respond to the situation in Bahrain? You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a number of people who'd like to talk to our guests, including David Gergen, who's with us, senior political analyst for CNN and director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. Ryan Salam is with us, columnist for the iPad news source, The Daily, and a blogger for the National Review Online. And Matt Iglesias is here, fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and a blogger at Think Progress. And Matt, let's pick up where we left off with you. President Obama's critics say it's not leadership when there's no clear plan in Libya and no exit strategy.
You know, there's never that clear a plan when you initiate a military action. There's always a lot of uncertainty to it. But where I think the administration does need more clarity is on the region-wide scope. I think there seems to me, and there seems to almost everyone, to be an inconsistency between the administration's approach to Libya and its approach to Bahrain and to Yemen. And I know people who think he's getting it right in Libya, and I know people who think he's getting it right on Bahrain, but I know very, very few people who think that he's getting it right on both of them simultaneously. There's a big tension here, and there needs to be some kind of explanation of why this makes sense, or else an adjustment in one place or the other to make it clearer where do we stand in the region as a whole. What is our attitude toward the democracy movements in the Arab world, and what's America's policy toward them? Right now, it looks quite fuzzy.
Ryan Salam, respond to that before we go to the phones.
Oh, I think that actually, you know, it's perfectly natural for the United States to be inconsistent if it is consistent with some broader national interest. So we could say that, well, in Bahrain, we have different interests. We're concerned about Iran, so we behave this way. And in Libya, we have this different interest. The trouble is that we haven't really articulated what that interest is. So I'd be willing to give the president some leeway on this if he could make a coherent case for why we're treating both situations differently. And we haven't seen that as yet.
As you know, Bob, there has been some talk in Washington. The president did want to give a comprehensive speech about the Middle East, and he hasn't. It's been delayed, and no one's quite sure why. There are rumors that there are some disagreements within the administration about what to say about Israel, especially about Jerusalem, but we'll have to see. But I do think, given the circumstances he's in now, it's imperative that when he comes back from his Latin American trip, he sit down with Congress to talk through Libya and these other countries, and then he give a gives this national speech we've been waiting for that does exactly what Ryan was talking about, what Matt's been talking about, and put this into a larger strategic framework and help the world understand what the United States is looking for.
Is he almost now more obliged than a few days ago to have that conversation with Congress, because he's taking a lot of flack from members of Congress on both sides of the aisle for not going to Congress before he took action in Libya?
Well, he did sit down with Congress before. He sat down with the leadership. Should he have consulted more widely? Yes. Obviously, he put getting approval of the UN far ahead of trying to get approval and agreement from the U.S. Congress. But we are where we are. And so I think when he comes back, I don't think he's done anything that other presidents haven't done in terms of the way he's resorted to war or conflict. But I do think when he comes back, it's essential that he sit down with members of Congress and try to reach some general understandings about where we're heading overall in the region, to deal with these contradictions that Matt has been talking about, and to then come to the American people and tell us where he's going, so that we all have a sense that there is a firm handle on this, and that there is an end game we have in mind. What kind of Middle East are we trying to build? After all, we have been, since the mid-1950s, really since 1956, we have been the nation that others look to help preserve stability in the Middle East, the one non-Arab, non-Muslim nation.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich has said he thinks not coming to Congress for approval before intervening might be an impeachable offense. Is he a little beyond the pale? You threw up your hands, David.
Is this the third straight president he wanted to impeach?
I think just about, yes. Let's go to the phones. Troop is calling from Florence, South Carolina. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Go ahead.
You know, I find myself in a unique position here in so much that I'm defending President Obama, but I cannot imagine that it is considered, you know, the catchphrase is dithering, I guess, we hear often, and I've accused him of it myself, but in this regard, doing a base of international support and letting the world see the fact that we are not unilaterally taking action. And, you know, you had my senator on there earlier, Lindsey Graham, stating, you know, the fact that how many lives were lost and how atrocious it was that we waited so long. And I can sympathize with the humanitarian aspect of that, but do you really think that it would hurt him politically or internationally to have built this, albeit smaller, coalition than what we had for the Iraq War, but nonetheless a coalition, and not taking unilateral action? I don't see how that could end up hurting him, and I see it hard to attack him on that front.
Ryan Salam.
Well, I think the question is a much deeper one, which is this. If it really matters to us, the outcome in Libya, who is going to control Libya, then surely it matters enough for us to insert ground forces. And I think that this is an objection that Senator Graham has raised, as well as Senator McCain, among many others. And if it makes sense for us to insert ground forces into the country, well, you know, we're making a very big and significant commitment. Instead, we're saying something very peculiar, which is that, well, it makes sense for us to make these surgical airstrikes. It makes sense for us to go just this far in a way that the Arab League half likes and half disapproves of. But it doesn't make sense for us to do anything else, and that doesn't create a stability of expectations. Rather, that creates a great deal of uncertainty that could only lead to more trouble down the road. So I understand this idea that, you know, if you're really going to go in seriously, you want to have a solid foundation, you want to have a broad consensus. But the thing is that we haven't made it clear at all that we really want to affect a particular outcome. And I think that that's my big problem with it.
Matt Iglesias, what do you say to people who say, if he went in for a dime, President Obama should have gone in for the whole dollar? In other words, not just the humanitarian role protecting civilians, but he should have moved to oust President Gaddafi. After all, he has said Gaddafi's time has passed.
I think there's something fallacious about that. I mean, the fact is, if you look at a map of Libya, you see there's really only sort of one road that connects the western part, where Gaddafi has a solid control, and the eastern part, where the rebels had mostly been in control. And I think it looks like at relatively low cost to the United States, we can provide air support to create a defensible, you know, rebel zone, prevent a massacre of people there, and so on and so forth. Whereas maybe that will lead to Gaddafi's fall, which I think the president would welcome, and maybe it won't, but that would still be an okay outcome at a relatively low cost to the United States. And to say, well, we should go much deeper in is really a whole separate question. I mean, I see the case that it's worth the price to pay to do a full-scale invasion and go all in on regime change, but I think it's perfectly reasonable to say there's a certain amount we're willing to do to help the rebels, but we don't want to go further than that.
Joe is calling from Leominster, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
The only comment I'd like to make is that it is in our Constitution that the president go before Congress if we are going to get entangled in another war, and he hasn't done that. And I know that you just mentioned that, but it really gets me heated up that we're entangled yet again, and there hasn't been a word about it to the people. Why do we have representatives that are supposed to represent us? Why do we have a Constitution? If these things are going to be blatantly ignored, why don't we just have a dictator who makes all the decisions for us without any counsel?
David Gergen?
Well, I think to give due credit to President Obama, he did send a letter late this week to the Congress, essentially invoking the War Powers Act and saying the Congress did put some restrictions on the use of presidential power in conflict after the Vietnam War. And the War Powers Act is one of the prime examples of that. And I think this president is trying to be consistent with the War Powers Act. I don't think he needs to go get a vote from Congress. After all, U.S. action is likely to be over here in the next two or three days, you know, for all intents and purposes. But what I do think he should have done and must do now is to get the Congress much more on board and in general agreement with him. I don't think he necessarily has to go for a vote, but I think he has to go for consensus.
There was a military risk in delaying any further in that Gaddafi forces were making gains in parts of the country against the rebels who had made gains earlier. And the argument was made inside the White House, as we understand it, that waiting another 48 hours might have been very severe in terms of maybe eliminating rebel opposition altogether.
But if we'd done it 10 days earlier, it would have been even better. Listen, this is not – he did not build this coalition. He wasn't been back scenes, you know, trying to carefully get other nations on board. The model for how to go into one of these things is George H.W. Bush and how he went into the Persian Gulf War. And then the Secretary of State carefully went around and built coalitions and got other people on board. In fact, he got other people to help pay for it. And that was – and got the UN to go for it and got the Congress to go for it. In this case, we were dragged into this by other nations. We changed our minds that whether we were against it and then now we're for it.
Okay, let's take another call. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Jill is on the line from Hamburg, New York. Hi, Jill. You're on Point.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
I believe that President Obama has been correct in this instance by waiting and taking his time and waiting for the UN and our allies to back us and have some kind of coalition before going into Libya. I don't think that we can be masters of the world, nor should we be masters of the world. And there are many more hot spots and major crises in the world right now than there were when President Bush went into Kuwait. It's quite a different world. I don't think you can wait and take a long, 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 long time building a coalition and then go in when everything is perfect. Nor should you go rushing in like some people were saying in this country, oh, my God, go help the rebels. So I think he's taken the correct stance, and I'm tired of everybody second-guessing every single move he makes like, any particular move is perfect. We are not the ones who control everything. There are many other circumstances and conditions, and I think the American people have to realize that it's good to have a president who can think, and we have one now.
Jill, let me ask you this question. A lot of people are wondering whether the American people have a clear idea of why we're there and what we're doing in Libya. Do you feel like you know what we're doing there?
I think that, yes, I think we're there because basically we've been for all the people's movements that have occurred since the eruption in Egypt. And it's clear that in Libya, Gaddafi has been a heartless, ruthless, grabber of everything that should be, he should be helping his people instead of hurting them. And I think that a lot of people here feel that, well, here's a case where if we can help the people take over in this country too, it's good. But I don't think the American people want to see our forces on the ground again.
Jill, thank you very
much. Because we've got two wars right now with our forces on the ground.
Jill, thank you very much for your call. Matt Iglesias, let me ask you that question. Do you think that in general, Jill is pretty well informed, do you think in general the American people have a clear idea of where, of why we're in Libya, what we're doing, and what the stakes are?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty clear in a general sense that we're there to help the rebels, but I think that the actual parameters of this mission simply are unclear, that the American people don't really know because it hasn't been articulated. It probably hasn't been articulated because the governments of the United States, United Kingdom, and France may not completely agree. Different elements of the United States government seem not to agree. And so, you know, the mission has not been explained in a crystal clear way because there's some fuzziness and there's an effort to build a consensus among different actors around what they're doing right now. But there's a lot of questions about hypotheticals and what we will do if certain things happen that I personally would like to know the answer to and that we haven't really heard an explanation of.
You know, President Obama in Chile yesterday, in Santiago, Chile, said that the U.S. was working to oust the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi. Let me play this soundbite and ask a question out of it.
It is U.S. policy that Gaddafi needs to go. And we've got a wide range of tools in addition to our military efforts to support that policy.
Is it confusing for the president to say we're doing the right thing, but we're only going to be there for a couple of days and then other people will take over? Rayhan Salon.
I think that statement seems to be saying something a little bit different. He's referring to these other tools. I assume he's talking about diplomatic tools, aid, and other measures that one could use. I do find it a little confusing that he's saying this is a very limited, selective intervention here. But by the way, we also have this broader goal of getting rid of him, and we're using these undisclosed other tools in order to achieve that end. And I want to say also that I'm analytically very sympathetic to what Jill had said earlier on. I think that starting from the recognition that the United States can't control outcomes is a very good and constructive one, given the various constraints that we face internationally and also in terms of our fiscal situation. But I think that, you know, it leads me to this different conclusion that we need more clarity rather than less in terms of our foreign policy, the goals that we want to achieve, not just in Libya, but also around the world.
David Gergen.
Well, to come back to it, I think the president did lay out pretty clearly a two-track approach to Libya. The UN resolution authorizing force for humanitarian purposes to stop Gaddafi from butchering people. The second track, the U.S., as opposed to the UN, continuing to support the ouster of Gaddafi, but not necessarily through military means, rather through sanctions and other diplomatic means. The problem is that what falls between the tracks, in effect, we've had a large use of American military power up front here. We have leveled the playing field to try to help the rebels. If the rebels now try to reestablish their positions in some of these villages and Gaddafi fights back, the rebels, you know, I think, have ample reason to believe that they're going to be helped by this, by the Western nations, that we've come down on their side, in effect.
Do you believe that we will provide air support to the rebels directly if they ask for it?
Well, that's just the very issue I think has not been resolved. Yesterday, the lead American commander in the theater, General Hamm, said, "We are not there to help the rebels. We are there to protect people from being shot by Gaddafi's forces, but we're not there to help the rebels if they go on the offense." Now, 2 or 3 days ago, Hillary Clinton said, of course we've got to help the rebels. Of course this is part of what we're doing. And I think it's left people confused. And one of the issues the president has to address, and we're going to have to show on the ground in the next few days, what are we going to do if this now returns to the civil war status and the rebels are fighting Gaddafi's forces? Are we coming down on their side? Are we going to let this go into a stalemate? I happen to believe a stalemate with Gaddafi in power in the western part of the country is a very bad outcome.
For reasons?
Well, first of all, he is going to be like a snake who has been wounded, and he is going to he's going to be harboring terrorism. He's going to be seeking retaliation in various ways. We've already been through, you know, him taking down commercial airliners in the past when he was wounded. And the U.S. policy now is, our policy is to get him out of there. If he's still there, our policy has failed. if he's still there, it sends a message to other dictators in the region. The way to succeed and to stay in office is to murder people.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, and today for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about presidential leadership in tumultuous times. David Gergen is with us. He served as an advisor to four U.S. presidents. Raihan Salam is with us, columnist for The Daily and policy advisor for Economics 21. And Matt Iglesias is here, too. He blogs for the website Think Progress. And let's talk about a few of the issues rattling around in Washington right now, especially up on Capitol Hill, and go to the federal budget. Amid the distinct and sharp lack of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. Will the president continue to just let Congress slug it out over the budget? Matt Iglesias.
Well, you know, the president released a budget proposal on schedule. It's out there. It has tables. It has charts. It has a CBO score. You can see it. Republicans don't like it. That's exactly what you would expect. And now I think what they're waiting for is for the House Republicans to write their own budget proposal. And then that would be the basis for, you know, both political attacks and discussion and debate, and also a basis for compromise. But to say that the White House should produce a second budget proposal before the Republicans put theirs on the table, I think doesn't really make sense. And it is just a kind of game. And it reflects the fact that the Republican caucus is having some trouble agreeing amongst itself as to what their position is.
Raihan Salam.
I think that the proposal issued by the president strikes many people, and not just conservatives, as a profoundly unserious proposal. We've seen a real goalpost shifting in terms of the president's rhetoric surrounding the budget towards this idea of primary balance being the goal. And when you look at what primary balance means, it means that we're going to leave out exploding interest payments on the debt, which of course makes it look as though balancing the budget is a lot easier, but doesn't actually address the underlying problem, which is that the burden of expenditures, which is going to translate into a future tax burden, is going to get bigger and bigger unless you take some fairly serious concerted action now. And I think that one thing that has really rattled a lot of people who supported President Obama, including a lot of the centrists, independents, and even Republicans who supported him in 2008, is this idea that early on he seemed to be the kind of guy who wanted to be a one-term president if necessary to do the job well. And instead, he seems to be very political. So yes, issuing an unserious budget proposal that actually increases spending by a really dramatic amount that doesn't achieve even the goal of having the primary deficit along the timetable that he had promised earlier on, that gives you a good negotiating position politically, but it doesn't get you to where the country seems to want to go, which is towards a sustainable spending situation.
David Gergen, what's the political calculation that the president, largely at least in the last few weeks, allowing the Democrats and Republicans to slug it out up on Capitol Hill and not diving into the trenches?
Well, I think he's been smart in one sense, and that is he realizes that had he put up a proposal for Social Security reform in the State of the Union address, it would have been cut to shreds, and it would have polarized people, and it never would have gotten anywhere. So he does want to get some indication from Republicans and indeed from fellow Democrats that they're willing to go along before he gets too far out in front. What we've learned here is that on these issues, if you go first, you often get slaughtered in the political trenches. Having said that, I'm going to make a distinction that Nelson Mandela often made about leadership, because that's what we're talking about here today. And that is, he said, Mandela argued, look, you can lead from in front, hold the flag, follow me, or you can lead from behind, pushing people along, hurting people along in the direction that you would like them to take. Mandela, during most of his political life, especially when he was in prison, led from behind. But right toward the end of his imprisonment, he intentionally got out front in order to have the negotiations with the South African government and led to the independence of South Africa and the wonderful changes that took place there. But you've either got to be leading in front or from behind. And I understand why President Obama is not leading from the front on the deficits. But what I'm surprised about is he's not leading from behind either. He could be behind trying to encourage the process along, recognizing that what we have right now, that the fights that are going on in Washington right now are a phony war. They're about a tiny piece of the budget. They're about 12% of the budget. We're having all the fights over, are we going to fund NPR? NPR is a tiny, tiny piece of as you know, of this whole effort. Until both sides are willing to get serious about entitlements, about defense, and about taxes, we're not going to see our way through to a solution.
So do you believe he will or will not tackle Social Security, the other big entitlement issues in the first term? Should there be a second term?
My sense from talking to people in Washington, including people in the White House, is there's a growing possibility all of this will be kicked down the road until after the 2012 elections, that the big issues are going to be kicked down the road. I would like to see it otherwise, and I think all of us are keeping an eye on this so-called gang of six. They got this sort of gang of 64 in the Senate to write this letter to the president. It may be that what we could see coming out of the Senate is the basis for some kind of grand bargain, which would be wonderful. I think the president could help that process along by talking to those people in that group on a regular basis, encourage them to move along. If you could cut a deal somehow with the Senate, then maybe you could go to the House Republicans and begin to have the basis for negotiations.
Matt Iglesias, is there any political upside to the president moving on these issues before the 2012 election?
I think there's lots of upside, but there's absolutely nothing to move on. I mean, I think that these criticisms of the White House on this are 100% unfair. The fundamental problem of budget negotiations is that all Republicans uniformly have the view that there can be no tax increases and that, in fact, we have to extend indefinitely the Bush tax cuts. As long as that's their position, there's nothing to talk about.
It would be great to
discuss entitlements and so on and so forth, but you cannot do it. You absolutely cannot unless revenues are on the table as part of the discussion.
I don't see that as an accurate portrayal. I was there in the room 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, when Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, the co-chairs of the Deficit Commission, had various people from various parts of the aisle. But here, Tom Coburn, a staunch conservative, stand up and say that for the good of the country, we may have to consider tax increases as part of this package. I think there are Republicans out there who are willing to go along as long as it's a comprehensive package and it's serious about trying to do something for the country. Will it be hard work? Yes, it's going to be extremely hard work. But we also have good Democrats like Dick Durbin, a liberal whom you would normally think was not ready to go and talk about entitlements. He's also standing up bravely, I think, saying we need a comprehensive package, and I'm willing to have entitlements on the table and look at Social Security reform.
Ryan Salam, weigh in on this before we go back to On Point listeners.
Yeah, I think that when you look at the tax expenditure situation, I think that there are a decent number of Republicans who'd be willing to move on that, provided they felt as though when you're talking about tax expenditures, you're talking about politically very popular measures like the mortgage interest deduction and the state and local tax exemption that really are tremendously expensive. And if you were to curb those things, you would generate far more revenue than if you, for example, raised marginal tax rates on a relatively small number of very rich people. And I think that is the big area where it could achieve some movement. But the thing is that that's going to be politically risky for both political parties. And that is one area where I think that the president might be able to hammer out a compromise with at least a minority of Republicans in Congress.
All right, let's hear more of what On Point listeners are thinking about this president. Alan is calling from Windham, New Hampshire. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for taking my call. You know, as has been pointed out during the show, we're dealing with a very complex issue, a very fast-developing issue, and a very critical issue. Why is our president handling this while on an international tour? Would we not be better served if he cut this tour short and took the helm in the White House?
David Gergen, you've advised many presidents. Would you be advising this president to come home to deal with Libya, to deal with the domestic crises, to deal with the continuing nuclear crisis in Japan?
Barack Obama made it clear during the campaign that, you know, if you're a president, you have to be able to juggle more than one ball at a time. And I think it's correct for him to be in Latin America. Latin America has become extraordinarily important to us, and I think it was long past time that we paid the kind of attention to it. So I applaud him for being in Latin America, but I do think when he comes home, he's got to get himself right back into the middle of these questions about Libya and the Middle East.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring another listener to the show. Terry is calling from Brewstertown, Tennessee. Hi, Terry.
Hello, Bob. Yes, I could probably do a three-hour show on the rebuttals or my views on the items that are brought up. But the major thing is that President Barack Obama is doing a far better job than several of the recent presidents with all of the different things that he's got to handle that he did not bring about. And his major detractors are using those detractions to take attention off of the things that they're responsible for. Because 10 years ago, they got tax cuts for the rich to create jobs. Where are the jobs?
Right, Hans Salam, do you want to weigh in here in relation to how you think this president, report card-wise, compares to the last few?
Well, here's what I'll say. I think that there are a lot of people who believe that, you know, if you had a lot of qualms with President Bush, President Obama represents a sharper version of a lot of objections. For example, Jack Balkin, who is not an enthusiast for President Bush, is a Yale law professor at Yale, who's talked about how much as President Eisenhower helped ratify the New Deal by continuing to support some of its essentials, President Obama went from a position of being very critical of the national security state that built up during President Bush to really strengthening it in many regards. And that's something that a lot of people have an objection to. If you look at the idea that President Bush engaged in a lot of reckless domestic spending, I think that there are a lot of people who believe that President Obama has done the same thing. There were many people, not just liberals, not just Democrats, who believed that President Obama was going to represent a break with many of these broad trends that we've seen in American life from our American presidents, and that, in fact, he's just deepened these tendencies. And I think that when David Gergen earlier on was talking about this idea of the president leading either from the front or from behind, the great barrier to that is a political barrier. The idea that the president is placing his reelection above some of these core national priorities and above the idea of changing course from what I think a lot of people agree is not a very good or constructive direction either on the international front or on the domestic front. So I'd actually say that I see a lot of continuity between President Obama and previous presidents. And like a lot of people, I don't like it.
Matt Iglesias, do you agree with that? Do you see that this president has perhaps placed getting reelected in front of dealing with significant national problems?
You know, I think that that's a sort of polemical way to put it. I think that you find that the president has a limited degree of influence on Capitol Hill, and that the amount of influence that any president has up there with Congress has a lot to do with his own popularity. So it's natural that people who want to get things done also want to bolster their own political standing. But, you know, the fundamental fact is that even when the president was riding high and had huge majorities in Congress, he couldn't just snap his fingers and get members to vote for what he wanted, and that Congress, you know, needs to lead itself or have leaders from within its own bodies if it wants to address complicated legislative issues. All politicians spend a little more time thinking about reelection and a little less time thinking about the good of the country than they really ought to, but I don't think the president stands out for special criticism.
Mary Ellen is on the line from Medway, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question is really, is it reasonable to really compare President Obama to previous presidents just in what he has to deal with from an international standpoint, from a security standpoint, and even from a communication standpoint with the Internet and the rise of Fox News and even some of the very, like what Reza just said, I felt like was a very broad brush, a lot of people believe. And I think that that resonates with people who are, so honestly, sometimes ignorant and want to just live their lives through sound bites of, you know, I think I'm such a huge fan of David Gergen because he approaches all of his newscasts. Every time I see him, he's so calm and he seems very metered, whereas I feel like there's this huge bias that's vehement, it's vitriolic, it's hyperbolic, all these things that I feel like I haven't seen other presidents have to deal with to this degree, let alone policy, budget, international crises.
Well, David Gergen looks completely unfazed by your praise of him right now. David, weigh in on this.
Well, first, Mary Ellen, thank you very much, Mary Ellen. There's no question that President Obama inherited a very bad hand. You know, he had the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. He had two wars and a world that's changing with incredible speed. And so he had a lot on his plate to deal with it. And I think he was young, and he was not used to some of these questions. And, you know, there was a time, I think, when he was a little overwhelmed by it all. There was a period right after the elections in 2010 when it seemed to me he really got his bearings, and he was very, very effective during the lame duck session of Congress. He worked well with Republicans. Everyone felt that there were some breakthroughs. We not only got an agreement, a bipartisan agreement on taxes, we got the START agreement, we got the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There was an awful lot that happened there. And somehow in these last couple of months, I don't know quite what's happening, but there's almost a sense that he's slipping back into this haze of caution, and you're not quite sure where he's going next. I think it could be a passing thing. I hope so, because I do think that it's really important for the country's sake, both internationally and domestically, that people have a sense that there is a strong leader and that America remains a strong leader. I think what we're seeing to some degree in what's going on in the Middle East is for the first time, we're looking at a situation in which no one seems to be leading, and it looks pretty messy and very unpredictable, and we're not sure how the Middle East is going to come out. I mean, there are these contradictions, as Matt has been saying, these contradictions that, you know, we go in and support the protesters in Egypt, Tunisia, maybe Libya, but, you know, and Yemen and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Jordan. We're not on the side of the protesters.
Raihan Salon, last word on this in the show today.
Well, I actually want to know what David thinks about the idea that previous presidents haven't faced serious vitriol. I think that the things that we disagree about in American life run very deep, and I think that it's natural for political arguments to get pretty harsh because we look at the world differently. And I think that's, you know, just natural.
And Matt Iglesias,
right about the vitriol.
And Matt Iglesias, last word from you in a few seconds.
Well, it's a difficult time, and I think it would be a challenging time for any kind of leader.
Matt Iglesias, fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, Raihan Salam, columnist for The Daily, David Gergen of CNN and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.